This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand, and welcome to the first Turn the Page of 2025. I was, in all honesty, I was supposed to do one last Monday, but there were technical difficulties, which were a certain presenter couldn't work out how to unlock the front door. It's all been sorted now. We're back into 2025. We're continuing with Don Farmer's book. We are exactly halfway through it. We'll continue with that. And then after that, I should have built up enough other stories and we can continue with those. So back to this. We were up to chapter 6. So here we are. Oh, what a night. She was a bit of a snob. Not outrageously so, but she was thought of as being a cut above the rest who had relied on her charm to get her through. But now she was old, unwanted, and about to be brought down to earth with a thud. The Hotel Midland, or Midland Hotel as she was always called, had graced Masterton's urban landscape for decades, her top story allowing her to gaze over town from her vantage point at the corner of Bannister Street and Queen Street. A proud old lady who had seen it all, but now her number was up. She was to fall victim to the wrecker's ball, to make way for a startlingly different edifice, the likes of which Wairarapa had never seen before. Her owners, the Masterton Licensing Trust, were to use the money from the sale of the site to help build a new gem in its portfolio, the Solway Park Hotel, but realised they couldn't just let her fall without a decent send-off. So a last night at the Midland was planned. Not overly planned, just the date given and the rest allowed to happen. And happen it did. The old pub's loyal clientele, history buffs and just about anybody who wanted a good night out turned up to say goodbye. The Midland's reputation for being slightly snobby had arisen because, unlike her rivals such as the nearby Pioneer, the Kurupuni Tavern and the Horseshoe at Masterton's northern entrance, she didn't have a designated public bar, only a private bar, a lounge bar and a dining room. What she did have above all was a very long history stretching back to the previous century. Not always under the same name, she was known by the early 1970s, but the same pub nonetheless. Way back in 1895, when the pub was known as the Club Hotel, she had been the site of Masterton's first murder since European settlement when a disgruntled workman, Andrew Somerville, had gunned down a contractor, Arthur Herbert, at the entrance to the pub. Nearly 50 years later, a massive earthquake that wreaked havoc throughout the lower North Island had sent the northern wall crashing down into the neighbouring premises, Woolworth's department store. Now it was time to say goodbye, and the farewell party soon got into full swing. Men and women packed out the pub, the bars crowded to capacity. Those who couldn't squeeze in took to the stairwells or simply sat down on the carpeted floor or in the foyer as manager Leith Hopkins and his staff scurried about trying to keep pace with the drinkers. Rick Long, newly elected as a trustee of the Licensing Trust, was delighted with the jovial atmosphere of the large gathering, although the whole occasion was tinged with sadness. All knew the old girl was soon for the chop, but meanwhile, let's drink, eat, and be merry. Among those enjoying themselves to the limit was Wairarapa Times Age chief reporter Mike Sims, a man not adverse to sinking a pint, and who was accompanied by several of his senior staff. Mike was wearing his favourite green and yellow sports coat, his red-brown beard bobbing about as he swapped anecdotes with a gathering of print and radio journalists who'd claimed spots for themselves on the stairs leading upwards from the ground floor. As the hours passed, the crowd gradually dwindled. As usual, the journalists were among the last to leave. It had been a fitting farewell. Next morning, the Times Age newsroom was a bit sluggish getting started, apart from the young ones, who had not been part of the revelry the night before. At 8 a.m., when the day was supposed to start, all who had been on board were, with the notable exception, the chief reporter. He was normally pretty punctual, and it was not long before his drinking mates, who had been to the farewell with them, realised Mike might be struggling to get his head off the pillow. Half an hour passed. Still no sign of Mike. It was then that a junior staffer noticed the wall clock in the newsroom had stopped, as luck would have it, only a few minutes beyond 8 a.m. "The clock's not going," he said. What an opportunity to poke the borax into the late arriving chief reporter. A senior reporter rose to the occasion. "Just take it down and put it on Mike's desk. He'll take care of it. Probably has a spare battery somewhere." The innocent cadet fell unwittingly into the trap. Within minutes, Mike arrived at work, his eyes and general demeanour clearly signalling he was not in good health or the best of moods. He stalked quickly towards his office, went inside, and roughly closed the door, a sure sign to those who knew him not dare disturb him until such time as the door was reopened. 10 seconds later, the silence was broken by an almighty roar. "Who's the bloody clown who put the clock on my desk?" Mike bellowed, peering out of the by now half-open door. To his credit, the cadet had the gumption to own up and was told in no uncertain terms to come here. The door was slammed shut again as the older journalists grinned and nodded to each other. The cadet was bawled out for all to hear for being a smart aleck. He emerged looking stunned and without being given any chance to explain. Around 10 a.m., the chief reporter's door was reopened. Things were obviously looking up, and a couple of older reporters slipped into Mike's room. "Hey, mate, you've been a bit tough on the young fellow. It's not his fault. We put him up to it." Mike looked sheepish. He knew he had overreacted to what was not intended to be a serious rebuke of a late-arriving boss. But he steadfast refused to call the cadet and apologise. "It will do him the world of good. This is a hard game, and he's got to know that," he said. It was a lame duck way of getting round the issue, but Mike was not as hard-hearted as he was making out. For several days after, he quite clearly cut the cadet a lot of slack, was complimentary of his work and encouraging. It wasn't long before the demolition of the Midland Hotel got underway. The site was cleared to make way for the building of perhaps Masterton's most controversial retail complex ever, the Centrepoint Mall. Almost directly opposite the site was Long's Butchery, run by Rick Long, who, besides being a butcher and a trustee of Masterton Licensing Trust, had a reputation throughout Wydad Upper, and most likely farther afield, as being a prankster extraordinaire. The butchery had two phone lines, but no step-down line, meaning there were two separate numbers for the shop. If someone telephoned the butchery to find the line was engaged, they needed to phone back on the other line. For years, Rick had been wanting to get a step-down line where that problem would be overcome, and when the Midland closed, he had succeeded, the butchery taking over the old Midland connection. One cold, wet afternoon, Rick answered the telephone with his usual introduction, "Long's Butchery, Rick speaking." The caller had not taken on it on board and asked, "Is that the Midland Hotel?" It was not an opportunity to be missed for natural-born prankster, and Rick confirmed it was indeed the Midland. The caller was a horse trainer from further north who was on his way south with a horse, due for a race at the Wydad Upper meeting, and wanted to book a bed for the night, him for himself and his wife. Rick tried to discourage the caller, but making things appear less than satisfactory for a married couple and their horse. "Right, but we only have two single beds," he said. "That's okay," came the reply. Rick tried again, intimating the room was totally unheated, but that too fell on deaf ears. The prospect of spending a wet, cold night in Masterton Hotel didn't seem to faze the horse trainer at all. "Well, I'll put a hot water bottle in each of the beds," Rick said as he signed off. For the next wee while, Rick kept an eye out, and sure enough, eventually, in the driving rain, a high-powered Chevrolet towing a horse float came slowly along Queen Street from the north, its windscreen wipers working furiously. As it approached the old Midland Hotel site, it stopped, its occupants checking the address. The driver got out and, battling the elements, walked over to the safety fence erected around what was just a hole in the ground, shook his head from side to side, checked the address with his wife, and then got back in his vehicle and drove away. Rick convulsed with laughter, reckoned the horse trainer must have thought the two hot water bottles had exploded and destroyed the hotel. He never did find out where the horse trainer had spent the night, but he reckoned he, as the man who took the booking, would have been the target of many remarks questioning his parentage. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to play the sort of the song that's my sort of get up and go song. So you know, if you're tired in the morning, you play this one. Before I had my interview, my job interview for the job I have now, I played this one. And I have played it before, but because, you know, this is 2025, we're, you know, gearing up for another year, I'm going to play it again. This is You're the Voice by John Farnham.
We have
Hours, You're the Voice by Johnny Farm. Right, rest of the chapter. Where do we get up to? The Midland had just disappeared, hadn't it? With the Midland Hotel consigned to history, the path was cleared for the building of what was to become the town's most controversial building, the Centrepoint Mall. Designed by a leading New Zealand architect, Roger Walker, as a joint venture between Ron Brearley and Bob Jones, Centrepoint's dominant feature was a 23-metre-high tower, which literally towered over the surrounding retail sector. Its 72 interior steps leading to a glass-encased platform for views over the town. Without doubt, it was a complete break from the tradition as far as Masterton people were concerned, and public opinion on it broke into two distinct camps. Either you loved it or you hated it. Supporters called it futuristic, a unique landmark, whereas detractors considered it to be a rabbit warren of uninviting small shops dominated by a tower that resembled a NASA rocket launch site. Those promoting Centrepoint were not helped by stories coming out of Britain that spoke of a London building of the same name, Centrepoint, that had been described as the most expensive dog kennel in Europe. The London version was a 34-storey tower block, at the time the tallest building in London, which had been unoccupied except for two guards and 20 guard dogs for 7 years. So before the first sod was turned, Masterton's latest planned addition to its central business district was a bone of contention, and nothing much changed. It was duly completed, and Deputy Prime Minister Rob Muldoon was lined up to do the honours at the official opening, which in itself was to prove to be conscientious and objective. 18 days before the opening, the national government, led by Jack Marshall, had been tipped out of office. Norm Kirk was now Prime Minister, and Muldoon was relegated to deputy leader of the opposition. The man with the crooked smile, who was to remain a controversial figure for the remainder of his life, and, like Centrepoint, was either loved or loathed by the New Zealand public, made a hash of the opening. He spoke little about the new complex, instead using the time to take swipes at the new government. News reports spoke of Muldoon chastising those at the opening. "Now you've got a government of railway workers, school teachers and trade unionists. I hope you're bloody satisfied." While some sniggered, even laughed, others hissed and booed. It was hardly the friendly, all-embracing start of the project organisers had hoped for. Trading in the mall started off okay, with shoppers prepared to give it a chance to settle in and prove its worth, but before long things changed. The shops were pokey, tenants were disgruntled over what they claimed were high rents, and the building had sprung leaks. Customers gradually deserted it, the tower was vandalised and closed to the public, and the whole operation was wound down. Centrepoint struggled on until June 1997. It was announced the complex, now largely untenanted, was to be demolished. And late that month, crews moved in to do to Centrepoint what had been done to the old Midland Hotel 25 years earlier. Winding back the clock to the year of the Midlands closing in 1972, it reveals that the people of Wairarapa were in a fairly buoyant mood overall. The year had started nicely. Police Sergeant Hendrikus Bos said he was delighted at the behaviour of the New Year revellers, and Wairarapa Racing Club Secretary Colin Roots was rubbing his hands with glee as 14,000 punters and picnickers had packed out the Tauheranikā racecourse for the first meeting of the year. The Lake Ferry Motor Camp was fully booked, and there wasn't a spare tent space to be had at any of the district's coastal spots. Sixth prize in the Golden Kiwi Lottery worth $1,000 was won by a Masterton ticket, with the nom de plume Best of Luck in Langland Supermarket was selling Watties tin peaches for 24 cents a tin, Nescafe coffee for 68 cents a jar, and a large hot rotisserie chicken for $1.69. In the meat department, leg chops were selling for 39 cents for today's equivalent weight of half a kilo, stewing chops for 29 cents and loin chops for 30 cents. But the good news could not go on forever. Beer prices were increasing, and happening which traditionally sent shivers down the spines of many men and a sprinkling of women, especially those who recalled the Black Budget of 1958, which had been largely responsible for toppling Walter Nash's Labour government. The price hike was fairly slight, although with the price of 35-ounce jug raising to 45 cents. Wairarapa's Hotel Association rep, John Reardon, said the price hike had been met with a definite tendency to buy jugs and preferences to glasses. After all, an 8-ounce glass would now cost 12 cents, meaning when drinkers calculated the cost-volume ratio, buying them at a jug saved them around 8 cents. As one wit observed, the more jugs you drink, the more you save. The Waingawa Freezing Works, a dispute broke out over the company's reluctance to pay dirt money to workers in the manure department. The works came to a virtual standstill, with only meat destined for the local trade being processed. After much wrangling, the dispute was eventually solved with the terms of an agreement. Oh, I need to go through the page. Employees and the meatworks union being reached, but with the details not disclosed. The union had sought 5 cents an hour increase in the flat rate to be paid to men in the manure and tallow department until such time as adequate dust collectors and ventilators were installed. On the traffic front, a warning was issued to drivers by the Ministry of Transport. Traffic officers would be paying close attention during the year to driving along the highway linking Masterton with the towns further south. Weekend drivers were to be especially targeted in an all-out effort to improve many aspects of traffic behaviour. Speeding was singled out as the biggest worry to the highway, particularly on the Masterton to Greytown stretch. And in the towns themselves, drivers were guilty of failing to give way at intersections. Horses, not cars, or the behaviour of drivers was the foremost mind of a very special Australian visitor. Master horse trainer Bart Cummings had come to New Zealand for the national yearling sales held at Trentham and decided to make a trip to Wairarapa to visit the horse studs. By 1972, the man who was to grow into a sporting legend had already trained 3 Melbourne Cup winners, achieving a hat trick in the 1960s with Light Fingers in 1965, Gailey in 1966, and Red-Handed in 1967. Even the affable trainer himself could not have imagined he would go on to train a record 12 winners of the big race and would earn a reputation worldwide as the Cup's king. In Wairarapa, he told reporters the quality of New Zealand bloodstock was continuing to rise, but also took the opportunity to criticise the rules of sale that required agents like Bart to give the name of whom a horse would be sold and the address of his bank. He said it was ridiculous, as many horses sold at the sales were bought without the buyer knowing for certain who would eventually own them to race. A big man with trademark bushy eyebrows, Bart never allowed success to overwhelm him and was always ready to mix and mingle with anyone who came along. Given the time and the opportunity, he would have loved nothing more than to have a day out at the Tauheranikau racing course, adding another patron to Colin Root's 14,000, and to have fired up the barbie and cooked some Langland supermarket leg chops. It's a fair bet he would have enjoyed a beer, especially at 45 cents a jug, and would have been quite happy sitting on the stairwell at the old Midland Hotel as the curtain came down on the grand old lady. Right, that is me done. That was a slightly shorter one. So I still have a few minutes left. One quick update. I mean, last year was very busy for me. I published 4 books. I will not be making a habit of that. The beginning of this year, we have one more. We've got another large print coming out. As it's plainly obvious, there is hardly any large print nonfiction, especially New Zealand history and even less Wairarapa history, so we're going to try and put more of them out there because some people like to read large print and I want to be able to do what I can to help them do that. So that's coming out February, all things going well. It's a large print version of the Marine Corps book that I did. And then the next one is not a book, but I'm working on my first ever documentary. I'm making a film, again, based on the Marines. While it's all still fresh in my mind, and ambitiously I am saying, that's coming out in May. It will be in the Wairarapa Film Festival. I've already filmed half of it, I've got a bit more to film, and then we start editing it, so we should be able to make that, but that's very exciting for me. So in terms of future books coming out, there's no new books coming out, but there is a new project, and it's going to be very interesting. After the film festival, and it's done its thing through that, I will be making it probably for free on YouTube. So if you have a modern TV and you've got the Wi-Fi and everything, you can just go straight into YouTube, We'll tell you how to find it and you can watch it from home. You don't have to go and pay to get a ticket, although if you do, I would definitely welcome you for that. So that's pretty much me done for today. I will not be in on Monday because apparently I worked out Monday's a holiday, isn't it? I think it's Wellington Anniversary Day. So I'll be skipping another episode and we'll be back the following Monday to continue delving through Don Farmer's book, Rummaging Through Life's Scrapbook. So look after yourselves, stay warm, stay dry. The weather is looking a bit dodgy. It's been like that for a while now. The lawns are all green and growing very, very nicely, which is great for the lawns, but got to keep mowing them. So we will see you in 2 weeks. Look after yourselves, and we'll see you then. See you later.